You're listening to a 95 BFM podcast.
You're tuned into The Wire. 1 hour of current affairs and analysis starting now.
Tēnā koutou katoa, ko Justin Wong Tokingua. E whakarongo ana koe ki te waia marunga irirangi pōho mō tēnei rā, tērā tekau mā wōru o whiringa anuku. Kia ora, you're tuned in to 95BFM and this is the Thursday Wire for today, October 28th, and I'm Justin Wong. E haere ake nei, coming up on the show today, we have our usual chat with Health Minister Andrew Little. Two cases of COVID-19 are detected in Christchurch, with one could be infectious in the community for up to 2 weeks. Festival drug testers are getting $800,000 in government funding for the summer. And should university students censor content or control student magazines? That's one of the questions on the feedback survey of Massey University's student magazine, Massive. As usual, he aha o whakaro, let me know what you think. Tukapatuhi mai, you can text me your thoughts on 5395 or waimairane. Call me on 309-3879. Particularly interested in your thoughts on what's happening in Christchurch right now, or what you think MIQ should be, considering it will be a revamp of MIQ will be announced at the 1 o'clock press briefing later today. Ko wa e ware ware e ahi ana koutou te whakarongo ki ene kōrero anohi pakihere rokiroki marunga i te pai tukutuku o irirangi pōho me haere ki 95BFM i rakati.com. As usual, you can catch more stories and other shows or past wires on the 95BFM website through BCAS. I tēne wā tonu. Now let's see what's happening in Christchurch.
Kei te whakarongo koe ki te waia, marunga irirangi pō.
The Wire.
There are now two positive cases of COVID-19 in Christchurch. Both cases are family members from the same household but are not vaccinated or regularly use the COVID tracer app. One case flew to Christchurch from Auckland earlier this month, returned a negative test before their flight, but they were tested positive on the second time. The case could have been infectious in the community for almost two weeks. The Ministry of Health is still yet to release any locations of interest. COVID-19 Response Minister Chris Hipkins says this morning one case has been unwell for a while and he cannot rule out a snap lockdown in Christchurch, and the government is expected to make a decision at 1 p.m. According to the Canterbury District Health Board figures, 68% of people have been fully vaccinated in the region. Mr. Hipkins said these figures are good and will have an impact on the spread of the COVID-19 virus. Christchurch Mayor Lyanne Dalzell told Stuff she is concerned by the lack of QR code scanning by the two cases and hopes the number of locations of interest would be minimised. Otago University epidemiologist Professor Michael Baker told me earlier that rapid antigen testing for departing passengers out of Auckland is needed to limit transmission out of the city.
It all depends on the risk assessment. At the moment, we don't know very much about the cases. The staff in Christchurch will be interviewing them, and they'll obviously look at a whole lot of factors like how long were they infectious for, where they went to, were they, for example, socialising with people in indoor environments, were they using masks, and so on. So a whole lot of factors will come into play. But given that at least one of these people has been infectious for probably a week or more in Christchurch, apparently they reported not to have been vaccinated and not to have used the contact tracing app very much, the QR coding or scanning, that might push it into being a higher risk situation. But we know that luck does come into it a lot when you're looking at a single case and a single cluster.
Okay, I might just talk about the QR code usage a little bit later. Well, on testing requirements, because we saw the Christchurch, one of the Christchurch cases was tested negative before they left Auckland and only tested positive only after they arrived in Christchurch. So should testing requirements for people who are travelling outside of the Auckland boundary from Auckland be tightened more?
It depends on the commitment we have to maintaining elimination of this virus across New Zealand. If we're really committed to that, then yes, we need to look at all the things we can do to limit transmission out of Auckland. And one is looking at testing requirements. We know that a PCR test taken a few days before travel will not pick up people who are infected just before they depart, which could have been the case with this person. So we might want to add in rapid antigen testing before they get on the flight, and that's becoming available now. The second thing is, of course, the most important thing is limiting the number of people who are travelling out of Auckland, at alert level 3 in the Waikato at the moment, to the bare minimum. That would greatly reduce the risk to the South Island and other places. And, of course, the other measure is vaccination. I think we should be at the stage now of requiring a vaccination of all people getting onto domestic flights for multiple reasons. I mean, it is an indoor environment where if a person's highly infectious, even if they're wearing a mask, they could infect people around them, particularly when they're getting on and off the flight. Secondly, of course, this is the way the virus, as we've seen, is getting around the country, so vaccination would reduce that risk. And thirdly, of course, it would encourage high vaccine uptake. So I really hope that Air New Zealand can be a real leader in this area to protect the health of their passengers and their staff by making this a requirement as soon as possible.
Okay, I'm now talking about QR code scanning. Is there concerns amongst experts that scanning uptake haven't been strong enough in regions, for example, in the South Island, where there haven't been as much COVID cases as the other ones?
Yeah, well, look, clearly this is a requirement now, so people should be doing it. And I think in general, probably people in the South Island have felt that they're somehow protected against this virus because there hasn't been transmission there for a long time. But I think now everyone in New Zealand needs to assume that they could be exposed to this virus very soon and act accordingly. And that means all the things we know are important. And obviously, if you have symptoms, then going and getting tested, scanning in, following the alert level rules, which will limit transmission. I think things like mask use indoors if you're in an indoor environment with anyone else. And the main one, of course, is getting vaccinated.
And should we be expecting some more cases like what happened in Christchurch and earlier in Blenheim?
Yeah, well, look, there's limited barriers on people who are infected flying all over New Zealand at the moment. So as the outbreak increases in Auckland, and if we can't stamp it out in the Waikato, we're just going to see more cases like this appearing across New Zealand. And I think there's huge public health benefits and also economic benefits with maintaining elimination across New Zealand outside Auckland for the time being until we've got very high vaccine coverage. And we've still got a lot of systems we have to get up and running, like the vaccine passport or green card or certificate, whatever we call it, and all the other systems we have to have in place, and particularly getting vaccine levels up to a level where they'll protect people across the country. And one other change I hope we can implement quickly would be introducing vaccination for children down to the age of 5. Now that this vaccine is looking safe and effective based on international trials, I think it would be very good if we could vaccinate all of our school-aged children so that they are vaccinated when they encounter this virus, which is obviously going to become more common in the future.
And before we go, I just have one more quick question about the MIQ announcement that is supposed to be upcoming today. So The government has forecasted there will be a shake-up on MIQ. We don't know what's happening yet, but what should be the ideal... Ideally, what should be happening to MIQ?
Well, we are shifting our policy settings. We were going to have more transmission of the virus in New Zealand, and therefore we can change our approach to people coming into the country. And I think that home quarantine with suitable precautions, I think, will be very useful for many people. And that the requirement, I think everyone's very aware of, you're going to have to be fully vaccinated to travel to New Zealand. You're going to have a negative pre-travel test. And if you're coming from a country which has low rates of disease, then that would all feed into a decision that you can quarantine at home with very low risk of bringing the virus into New Zealand. You will still need MIQ, but they'll be used for different groups now. They'll be used perhaps just for travellers coming from countries with high rates of infection. And, of course, increasingly they'll be used for people who are infected with this virus in New Zealand and where it may be quite unsafe for them to isolate at home. Say they're in a very crowded house or there are vulnerable people there or there are other complicating factors. They'll be the people who go into MIQ more. And it's just now recognising that the risk from infected people, say in Auckland at the moment, is often going to be higher than the risk from people travelling to New Zealand from low-incidence countries.
And that was Professor Michael Baker from the Otago University down in Wellington. One text came in, says, it seems insane anyone can leave a plague zone to an area that is clean without providing proof of immunity, but this has been going on since August. And keep your texts coming in. The text number is 5395, or if you want to talk to me, the number is 3093879. But leaving COVID for a bit, now let's hear from...
Now it's time for our weekly chat with Labor MP Andrew Little.
This week with Health Minister Andrew Little, I asked him about two pieces of legislation in Parliament, including the Paia Ora Healthy Futures Bill that reforms the entire New Zealand health system and public consultation for repealing and replacing the Mental Health Act. But I started by asking about the government's decision to give $800,000 of funding for recreational drug testing services.
Obviously, last summer season, we had the drug testing law in place that protects the people who are offering drug testing services. It means that people, and particularly going to music festivals, if they've got recreational drugs and not quite sure what's in it, then they can get them tested and they know what the substances are. And it showed quite a high incidence of people actually having purchased something, actually it not being quite what they thought they were purchasing. And therefore it was safe for them, they can make a decision about whether they continue to consume it or not at all. What we're doing for this summer is supporting those drug testing services. There's a couple now who've got certification to do drug testing and to provide them with some funding so they can train their staff who are actually doing the testing and also develop some educational materials for people who use those services. We're currently putting through the law that makes the drug testing law a permanent feature of our statute books. The one at the moment, it was only ever intended to last for a year or so. And then once that law is passed, we'll look at further support, not just for those doing drug testing at things like music festivals, but those able to offer services year-round, particularly for, you know, people living kind of alternative lifestyles, sometimes living on the street, who are getting access to substances that they don't really know the origins of, and they'll be able to get access to testing for that.
Okay. Last year, the one-off bill is only designated Know Your Stuff as the main drug testing provider. Have you got more expression of interest since last year?
Yeah, well, there's now two organisations now have certification for drug testing, Know Your Stuff and the New Zealand Drug Foundation. I understand that there are two others who have applied for permits to be drug testers and they'll be considered very soon. So there's a growing number of services being offered.
Okay. Well, considering the drug testing bill is still stuck at our select committee and the first festival is scheduled to be on by the end of this year, are you cutting this a little bit too fine?
Well, the intention was to have the legislation, the one currently in the House, passed by December, by early December, so we're still on track for that. I'm confident that we will get that. And what that will do is carry over any organisation that currently has a permit to offer drug testing, that permit will carry over until the newer kind of bureaucracy is in place for under the new legislation, and then any other applications can be considered from there. So I'm confident we will have good cover for the forthcoming summer season.
But considering, like last year, that because the bill was passed so late that Rhythm and Vines and Northern Base can't set up properly their drug testing facilities, are you sure that won't happen again?
Well, I'm confident that there will be more drug testing services available, and with this additional money, this $800,000 to provide training for people actually running the services, there'll be more capacity. What particular festival organisers pick up or offer will be obviously a matter for them, but I'm confident that we will, you know, we'll have more people available to do testing this summer than we did last summer.
Are you, well, you said you want to, earlier, that you want to, you have plans to expand this to all year round. Does that include clubs and bars as well?
The idea is that we're not just setting this service up for music festivals in the summertime. That becomes quite a narrow kind of audience. There are plenty of other people who don't go to summer festivals who are consumers of recreational drugs and other substances, some of which can be quite dangerous if you don't know what's in them. So we do need a set of services that are operating year-round. It could be clubs and bars, and we also want it available to people who don't frequent those places but who are consumers of substances and who ought to have access to ways of getting assurance about what those substances actually are.
Moving on to my second topic of the day, now you recently announced public consultation for repealing and replacing the Mental Health Act. Well, considering there's already an amendment in Parliament amending the Mental Health Act that's already at third reading, what's the difference between these two?
Yeah, so the amendments that we're going through Parliament at the moment are really, it's a very small number of amendments to deal with some of the more egregious kind of problems with the current legislation. So indefinite treatment orders, the fact that particularly for forensic mental health patients, you know, those who've accused of committing a crime and who need to be transported, powers to transport them safely using restraints if necessary, and also the right of family members to attend appointments by audiovisual. So if they've got a family member who's being assessed or going to a professional, the patient is entitled to have a support person or family member there. Under COVID conditions, very difficult, so we set up a regime where the family members could attend by audiovisual. So it allows for those sorts of things. When the Hei Ara Oranga report, when it came out, it criticised the Mental Health Act, the whole of the Mental Health Act, but said that these were things that needed immediate attention. So we agreed we'd do this in two stages. We'd fix the most problematic areas so that we were more human rights compliant than we would be had we not done that. And then we're doing the repeal of the entire legislation. That's the exercise that's now underway, the consultation exercise. So we've gone out with a document to the community and said, right, what does a modern piece of legislation look like that means that we can provide the mental health care, particularly for people who are in crisis and who may not be able to make decisions for themselves? How do we make sure that they get the support and treatment that they need? So that is the big project that is underway. The stuff we're doing at the moment is just fixes some obvious problems pending the full repeal and replacement of the law.
But why amend the Act when you already have plans to repeal and replace the Mental Health Act altogether?
Because things like that, so for example, the current law where you can basically be admitted to a mental health unit under an order or certification by two mental health professionals, if that is renewed after 6 months, that then becomes indefinite. And that becomes very problematic for people who actually, you know, people do recover after treatment and help and support, but they're under this indefinite treatment order. That was one of the things that the Hauda Oranga review said was actually in breach of basic human rights, that if you're under a compulsion order, there ought to be regular points of review. It should never fall into being indefinite. Likewise, for people who need to be transported but who are a risk to themselves and possibly others, you need a law that means that they can be transported safely. So there were obvious things that stood out for immediate attention, bearing in mind that once we complete the consultation exercise on the full repeal and replacement, it'll be the end of next year before we kind of draw that to a conclusion and then can look at the new law, and therefore 2023, possibly even 2024, before the full replacement law is passed. And that's another, you know, couple of years of people whose, you know, human rights have been compromised.
Okay. Minister, before we go, do you mind if I just have a quick question about the health sector reform bill yesterday?
Sure.
So it was passed first reading last night, but now the bill has been sent to a special select committee instead of the regular health committee. Why have you taken the decision to do that?
This is a major reform of the health system, but one thing this legislation does in a way that we haven't done in health and possibly in any other area of government policy is treat very seriously the findings of a recent Waitangi Tribunal report and actually specify, you know, how we fulfil the Crown's obligations under the Treaty of Waitangi. So there's a very important clause that the Treaty of Waitangi principles part of the law is unlike any other piece of legislation we've passed. Ordinarily, what we write into law, we say, look, the Crown will give effect to the principles of the Treaty of Waitangi, and that's it. And we leave it at that, and the courts then work out whether or not that's, you know, what that is, what it means, how it means to give effect to those principles. This, because of a recent Waitangi Tribunal decision, actually spells out what health principles look like for the purposes of the Treaty of Waitangi. And we've incorporated that into the law. So we think that will attract a lot of attention. And given that, you know, in addition to the statement of principles, we've also provided for the Māori Health Authority, we're beefing up the iwi Māori partnership boards, there's quite a bit here that is addressing the major failing in our health system at the moment, which is that equity failing when it comes to Māori. We think there'll be a lot of submissions on that. And so this becomes a law not just about the health system, but about equity in the health system and compliance with the Treaty of Waitangi. And we think both of those elements need to be covered off with a select committee with people on it, drawn from those particular areas of competence who can sit on it. So that's why we set up a separate committee.
Who will be on the select committee?
Well, that's up to each party to decide, and we'll determine ours over the next couple of weeks, and then it'll be for the committee to decide who the chair and deputy chair is. So that is all yet to come in the next few weeks.
That was Labour MP Andrew Little.
The Wire.
Ko te Wire, tēnei maurunga irirangi pōho. You are tuned into the Thursday Wire on 95 BFM, and that was our weekly chat with Health Minister Andrew Little. It's 28 past noon here in Tamaki Makaurau, Auckland. We will be back after a quick break to talk more about festival drug testing.
New Leaf Kombucha is New Zealand's only pure kombucha taproom.
Everything you need from your kombucha. 5 different varieties on tap, even more in bottles, all brewed organically with no flavourings, colourings or preservatives.
Try their new Hop Butcher, New Leaf's trademark non-alcoholic beer brewed with kiwi hops. Everything you love about beer without the beer.
New Leaf Kombucha, New Zealand's only pure kombucha taproom. Visit today at 37 Crummer Road, Grey Lynn. Door sales only during level 3. Also, they've got a talking parrot. Come on!
Southbound Records, New Zealand's largest range of new vinyl, a fantastic curated selection of secondhand, plus all the accessories you need. Brushes, cleaners, sleeves, crates and more.
There's never been a better time for vinyl, and there's never been a better time to support your local independent record store. Southbound Records. Order now at southbound.co.nz for courier delivery or contactless pickup at 132 Simon Street.
Okay, I got up at 5 a.m. I waxed on my board. I waxed off my board, which was a mistake because then I had to wax it again. I'm ready to go surfing, bruh.
Did you watch Point Break?
Yes.
I don't know.
Come on, we do everything together. We're like Simon and Garfunkel. We're Hall and Oates, bruh. We're like the sexy twins from Bros. Let me come surfing with you.
Oh, damn. Actually, look at that. Solid zero on the west coast. Surf's off, Soz.
Come on!
The 95 BFM Surf Report. All the surf, all the time. Weekdays on Breakfast and Drive. Thanks to Pro Gear Photographic.
Why should New Zealanders care so much about this?
Because your children will curse you if you don't.
The Wire.
Following our earlier chat with Health Minister Andrew Little on funding for festival drug testing, I spoke to Yvonne Boyson from drug testing service Know Your Stuff, and I began by asking her whether $800,000 is enough for them.
Yeah, I mean, obviously it's fantastic news to be receiving funding for what we are doing. Know Your Stuff has been in operation for the last 7 years, really almost entirely funded by volunteers with occasional grants from charitable trusts. So to receive some funding of this kind of scope is really exciting.
So usually how much money does it take for you to set up shop at a particular festival?
Well, it's difficult to quantify how much that costs for us specifically. You know, Know Your Stuff is an organisation with a compound growth rate of 80% every year in the last few years. And so, you know, a few years ago, our total operating budget for the whole year was $6,000. Obviously, as we scale and the requirements on us increase, then that has started to cost us more money. Our equipment is quite expensive, and, you know, getting people to events as well as our setup.
Right, but when it comes to $800,000, what scale does it look like? How many more testing machines can you get for that money?
Well, our understanding currently is that this funding is operational funding, and so that mostly goes towards, instead of necessarily new equipment like new spectrometers, that will go towards us being able to finally actually compensate some of our volunteers in year-round roles and give us a baseline to be able to scale, maybe not in time for the summer, you know, it's already nearly November, but it gives us enough room to start to pay some of our people who are also doing advocacy work and partnership work with other organisations who want to provide drug checking. So the scope's really too big just for Know Your Stuff to cover the whole country at every event, yeah.
Yeah, it's almost November. Do you think this funding comes at the right time or a little bit too late?
I think it's difficult to define a right time, you know. There's always going to be an argument of, oh, this could have been more convenient at this time or that time. We will work with the government with this funding to get as far as we can in time for the summer. If not, it's a fantastic future-proof investment that will have benefits for multiple years down the line.
Are you guys busy this summer?
If we have festivals, I mean, we will be busy regardless, but we're planning to be, yes.
In terms of drugs, last year you found most of MDMAs, well, the pills that are claiming to be MDMAs out there are actually bath salts. So are you expecting this situation to continue this summer as well?
Yeah, I mean, it's a bit too early in the season for us to really say what we're going to be seeing, but we would, you know, see no reason for that to have changed necessarily. You know, the pandemic's still well in order, and drug checking services overseas is also seeing a lot of counterfeit MDMA, whether that be cathinones or other substances. So, yeah, we would still expect potentially a lot of counterfeit MDMA in New Zealand this summer.
Why is so much counterfeit MDMA in the festivals, especially during the pandemic?
It's so hard to say for sure, you know. Obviously, we don't have the kind of oversight of a supply chain that we would with a legitimate business, but we expect that the pandemic has impacted the ability of substances to move around in the way that they used to. And, yeah, whether this is involved in, you know, some people shutting up shop and new people coming in to replace them, or exactly how that mechanism has happened, we're not quite sure.
Okay, I might just go back a little bit on urethelones or bath salts. So what difference do they make compared to regular MDMA pills?
Right, so urethelone is one of a family of substances known as cathinones. These used to be called, or these are sort of known as bath salts because they used to be sold legally under that name as bath salts. Whether anyone actually put them in their baths, we'll never know. But essentially, they are a family of stimulants. Some cathinones have effects that are not as harmful as substances such as urethelone. Urethelone tends to have less euphoria and a more variable onset. Some people have described it as being faster and wearing off faster. Some people have described it as the opposite, being slower and wearing off slower than MDMA. The main thing is that it seems to produce a shorter period of euphoria followed by a period of up to 3 to 4 days of anxiety and paranoia. A lot of people report a lot of difficulty sleeping it has kind of been linked to heart palpitations, other sort of ongoing health conditions.
3 or 4 days of anxiety. I guess that's probably the main reason why people should get their pills tested.
Not the most fun way to ring a New Year's, hey?
No, of course not. So just before we go, can you remind people who are listening how does this process go if you suspect your pills are not actually MDMA?
So if people have something they want to get tested this summer, we should be publishing our calendar. At some point it will be public knowledge which events we will be at, so we hope. But really the process would be to bring in a sample and to give a small amount of that to us. We will then test it, and people can come back and find out what their results.
How long will that take?
It depends on how many other people are using the service at the same time. A spectrometer test on a sample only takes a few minutes, but when we have a few hundred to get through, that can be, you know, last summer we had wait times of 2 to 3 hours. We're trialing a new operating model to hopefully reduce that somewhat.
Is it a good thing to see many people to get their pills tested? As you said, there's quite a long waiting time last summer.
It's fantastic to see so many people, you know, taking the time to prioritise harm reduction and to essentially, you know, get some information so that they can make the best decision for themselves around their own substance use. So, yeah, it's been awesome to see the service being so popular.
And that was Yvonne Boydson from drug testing service Know Your Stuff. And I also spoke to Splore Festival's director John Minty, and I began by asking what he thought about the new funding.
You know, I mean, the government's moved actually quite quickly on it, which is good in terms of legalising the use of drug testing last season, and obviously now coming through with funding to back that up. Because the group that primarily do the testing, Know Your Stuff, we've been working with them for about 6 years now at Splore. And we've obviously been contributing to their costs, obviously, because we believe in the service. But I know they don't necessarily get remuneration from other places they go to. So it's been hard for them, so this will definitely help them.
Right. Drug testing was briefly legal at the last Splore. Did you see more people get their drugs tested?
Fractionally more, a little bit. I mean, we've had Know Your Stuff at Splore now, like I say, I think for 5 or 6 years, so explorers know that they are there. Up till last year, of course, that was more of word of mouth. So, explorers are pretty used to them being there, so it wasn't a massive increase, but significant, yeah.
Do you expect more people to use the service if it goes ahead?
Well, the service goes ahead. I mean, they are at a number of festivals, Know Your Stuff. What the limit is for them is they don't have enough spectrometers to actually analyse the drugs. And the funding that they've currently got from government won't be enough for them to get new spectrometers in for this summer season. So that's the only restriction for them to be able to expand the service. Because obviously drug testing needs to be in other places apart from just festivals. There are a lot of other areas where obviously drug testing would be very handy to have for good health outcomes. You know, even drug testing, I don't know, down in Courtney Place or Auckland City on a Saturday night. I mean, that's where services should be. A little bit like the needle exchange services I've had in Auckland for a number of years.
And has drug testing affected the number of incidences of drug-related incidents at Splore?
Yeah, we brought Know Your Stuff on about 5 years ago because we'd always had instances of people getting medevaced out, sort of overdoing it, quite often a combination of drugs and alcohol or getting dehydrated. And, you know, as a festival operator, you know, we can't stop drugs coming in. They come in. So from a health point of view, we're thinking, well, how do you minimise the harm? So since we've had Know Your Stuff on site, yes, we've definitely had less and less medical emergencies relating to drugs over the last few years. Stuff, when they do drug testing, they do a full report on what they've actually found. So they do a very, very comprehensive report on the types of drugs that have been found, percentages of things I've tested which were supposedly meant to be one thing but weren't. So they provide that full report to festival owners so that we know exactly what's been happening. And they'll do that next year as well.
And that was Splore Festivals' Director John Minty talking to me about drug testing at festivals. And moving on to our final story today, an annual feedback survey for Massey University's student magazine Massive has raised eyebrows on questions about censorship and editorial control. Massey University has 10 student associations for all of its students in Albany, Manawatu and Wellington, as well as distant learning, and they make up the Massey University Students Association Federation, or MUSAF. The survey by MUSAF asked students whether it is the right of student associations to censor magazine content or whether the editor, MUSAF, an individual student association should retain editorial of Massive magazine. It comes as numerous magazines over the country have to battle their own student associations for editorial independence. Canterbury University's Canter magazine only got out of an arrangement last year in which the student association's communications manager had to sign off each issue before it goes to print. Fatima Imran is the president of the Massey University Student Association at Manawatu, which is a member of MUSAF. I asked her this morning why the survey was there.
It's just supposed to be like a review. To see how the students or even the associations, any stakeholders of Massive, to see how they're feeling about the magazine. Is there anything they need to change? Are they wanting to change? Are they happy how they are? Just so we can, well, the association or the Massive can move ahead in a light that best serves their stakeholders in a way.
But who wrote the content of the magazine? Who wrote the content of the survey, the questions?
So that's MUSAF. So we have our change general manager. We basically doing a review. So a list of questions were put in there just to see what, I guess, people think. So nothing's definite or any way. It's just supposed to gauge the audience and see what their views are.
Right, but some of the questions, including one that's asked whether editorial control should be given to MUSAF or an individual student association or even a media board. Do you think that's appropriate?
Personally, I'm honestly like one vote or one voice on the table. I wouldn't have much of an opinion because I don't come from that background. And honestly, my engagement with Massive is the same as any student. I guess the point of that question was, because we did get a few concerns this year regarding the magazine and some content. So just to allow students or people who had those issues, do they wish that that changes? It wasn't a definite, it wasn't, hey, look, we're going to do this. It was more like, we've heard concerns, we've heard what you've said. Now, do you want us to mitigate this issue or are you fine with how it goes?
What sort of concerns have you heard back?
So we've got, like, just the content in terms of, like, we have Massive has, like, sex issues, has drug issues, and, like, as in issues as in the magazine. So, like, questions, so we've had concerns regarding, I don't know, like, some wording of the articles as well as some photos, and as our audience is very, they want to be engaged more. We get a lot of them, and so just concern, just as questions or around that, mitigating those issues.
Okay. There's another question surrounding censorship. Is it the role or right of student associations to censor magazine content? Do you think it's appropriate to have to put what should be censored in a student magazine up for a public vote?
I think that's a very good question. Personally, I personally think student associations shouldn't have the right to. That's just my personal view, because the student magazine is not there to, I guess, be controlled by the student association. That's just my personal view. And I guess the public voting, it's not directly as a vote or so, it's just to see what people think and take into consideration and further steps if need be. But my personal view would be, I personally don't think I have the right to say, hey, look, Massive, you cannot write this. And we can voice our opinion, but how they get taken on is, I guess, their choice.
That was Fatima Imran, the president of Massey University Student Association down at Palmerston North in Manawatu. Massey Wellington Student Association is also another member of MUSAF, and I asked their president, Tessa Guest, this morning what she thought of the survey question on censorship.
That's a question that isn't, like, that's an opinion that isn't held by everyone. Certainly not MORSA, MORSA's executive. We don't hold that opinion. But those are questions that have been raised by some people. And it was, so that's why it's included, because people wanted their opinion to be heard, or I guess wanted the opportunity to express their opinion. So the question's there. That doesn't say anything about whether or not anyone agrees with it.
When it comes to editorial control, where should it go, in your opinion?
Yeah, I think in my personal opinion, and I think the opinion of my executive, it should remain with the editor. That has no reflection on anybody else's opinion. We're working together. I think the complexity of Massey is that there are four general student associations, and for Māori and Three Pacifica as well, that all are involved in this conversation. I can't speak to anybody else's opinion. But for us, we believe that editorial control should remain with the editor. And absolutely, there can be space for other guidance, I think. But I think it should stop with the editor.
And that was Tessa Guest, the president of the Massey at Wellington Student Association. The time is up to 12 to 1 here in Tamaki Makaurau, Auckland. We will be back after another break.
Close your eyes, turn up the radio, listen to the music. It's Buddha, the new album from Luke Buddha. The Phoenix Foundation frontman's third solo album has it all. Sparkling songbook melodies, big pompous guitar solos, and collaborations with the likes of Don McGlashan, Ricky Gooch, Mott, and more. Luke Buddha, new album, Buddha. Out now on vinyl and digital wherever fine music is sold.
Fun-sized chocolate bars, baby animals, shiny dollar coins, me. Good things come in small packages, and what could be gooder than Show Me Shorts, New Zealand's biggest little film festival. As a lockdown treat, they're heading online. For a limited time, they're bringing you the whole 2021 program of more than 70 local and international short films on demand, so you can get stuck in without leaving the house. Show Me Shorts, on now till October 31st. Go to showmeshorts.co.nz.
Birds are singing, lambs are lambing, the sun's giving us a cheeky thumbs up from behind a cloud.
Summer's on its way and it's bringing the 95 BFM merch shop with it.
Shirts, beanies, hoodies, bucket hats, caps, totes, face masks, all proudly emblazoned with the good old 95 BFM logo and all available for a strictly limited time.
But that's not all.
We've also hooked up an exclusive once-in-a-lifetime extremely good-looking shirt designed by the one and only Anandunka.
Everything is made to order, so once it's gone, it's gone. The shop opens for a very limited time from this Monday, so stay tuned and get shopping.
At this radio station, we do our utmost to abide by the Broadcasting Standards Authority and their rules and guidelines. If you seriously think we've crossed the line on air, give us a call on 309 4831 within 20 working days of the broadcast date and tell us about it. We'll be able to help you out and tell you the procedure if you wish to make a formal complaint to the Broadcasting Standards Authority. Fuck knuckles, cock and piss. Balls. Thank you.
That was The Wire.
Ko rite hotaka katoa mo tēnei rā, and that's all for the Thursday Wire today, October 28th. Nē te mihi kia koutou katoa I korero ki a mātou mo tēnei rā. Thanks to those who spoke to us today. We had Andrew Little, Professor Michael Baker, Fatima Imran, John Minty, Yvonne Boyson, and Tessa Guest. E whakarongo ana koe ki te irirangi pōho. You're still tuned into 95BFM, and Sigrid is here now for the 124 before Johnny and Big Hungry's drive show comes online at 4. Nē te kahoki mai mātou a te rā wiki. Enjoy the rest of your week, and I will see you next time. Mā te wā.
That was a 95BFM podcast. Support 95BFM with a B-card. Go to 95BFM.com/signup.